You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel.
Coming up this week in episode 258, we look back at the last 7 days. More journalists laid off, this time at Vice News and the Daily Telegraph. Mourinho to Manchester United. Is it a match made in heaven, or are the Red Devils on the highway to hell? Oh, and please, please don't send Robbie Williams out to the supermarket to buy you a cucumber. Oh dear, that's all coming up right after Clash City Rockers.
From Juliet, from 1978, yes, and signifying a change from being noisy agitators to a period of about 18 months when they really were the best band in the world, the Clashing Clash City Rockers.
I love the tightness of that, how it's really poppy yet really uncompromising at the same time. I nearly picked Clampdown, which is similar for me, I think, in terms of that kind of really good, I don't want to say power punk pop because that's not what they are at all, but it does have shades of that, I think. It's got a real kind of purpose to it, which I love.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. As I say, it was the start of a period that ran from early 78 Clash City Rockers and last about 18 months through a few singles that weren't on albums, the Cost of Living EP, and then into London Calling, where they really were probably the best band in the world. And then it kind of after the peak of London Calling, it kind of went all downhill with an absurd triple album.
I wonder what your policy was on Sandinista, but that doesn't surprise me that is your policy.
Not good. Might have made one just about scraped into one single album if they'd have taken, you know, two thirds of it away.
But I read a book years ago. I can't remember who the author is, but it was a sort of, you know, just kind of a light reading book called Sleb, about someone that accidentally becomes famous. And there's a sort of plot line in it. There's a chap called Tony. Basically, a tube train gets, it's almost sort of Ben Elton-esque, a tube train gets stopped underground, and it ends up sitting there for hours on end, about 4 or 5 hours, and people have panic attacks and people start screaming. There's a young chap called Tony that sat there, and he's sat reading a book. He's really happy. He doesn't really notice what's going on. He has Sandinista by The Clash on his headphones, and it's a triple album, and he listens to it all the way through twice. That's how long the tube train is stuck there, and doesn't really understand why everybody else is panicking so much. And then when they come up to the top and he's interviewed by a TV camera, he says, oh, I listened to Sandinista twice. I don't know what the problem was on his Walkman. He then becomes a kind of flavour of the week and is invited onto various talk shows to sit there in the background pretending to listen to music. So whenever I think of Sandinista, I think of that storyline in that novel.
I doubt whether anybody else has ever in the history of popular listened to the whole of Sandinista twice, all the way through
it. Yes, exactly.
In succession, indeed.
But, you know, they say that, you know, fiction is stranger than truth, isn't it? So,
welcome to the Parish Council podcast, episode 258, brought to you by the Media Motel. I'm Terence Stackham, and that was indeed Sussex's own Clash City rocker, Juliet Harris.
Indeed, and for fashion fans that are interested in what I'm wearing, the season of the onesie is well and truly over. So the Force has awakened, and I am wearing a snazzy The Force Awakens t-shirt, which is meant to refer to Star Wars, but I feel that it has some personal connection to me.
Oh, I say, Juliet, last year when making yet further job cuts at Trinity Mirror, specifically at the Birmingham Mail and Coventry Telegraph Mirror titles, the Mirror Group put out a statement that contained this sentence, and I quote, "The days are long gone when we could afford to be a paper of record and dutifully report everything that happened on our patch."
Gosh.
And yes, well, that rather chilling sentence came back to me this week when we learned that Vice News laid off members of its editorial team and several correspondents, but also, and perhaps even more significantly, at the Daily Telegraph here in the UK, where layoffs were described in the most odd way by Murdoch McLennan. He's the chief executive.
Why are they all called Murdoch? Why are all the media people called Murdoch?
Yes, it's most unfortunate. He's the chief exec at Telegraph Media Group. And he spoke of the layoffs by saying this. He said, "With changes in the way we work and hot desking for some of those who need to be in the office, we will be able to reduce the size of our footprint at Buckingham Palace Road." That's where the Telegraph is based. And it was rather an opaque way of referring to redundancies, reducing their footprint. It was redundancies for several senior Telegraph figures. Now, Jules, two things. What a strange way to go about losing staff, but also, with the collapse of the New Day newspaper earlier this month,
which we did sagely predict, can I point out, in our initial podcast.
We did indeed, yeah. We're surely seeing the end of the era of the traditional press, and sooner, really, rather than later.
Well, yeah, I agree. We're in sadness. I agree. I know we've spoken previously about whether or not we still buy newspapers, and I've talked about you suspected I did still buy newspapers, but by and large, I tend to consume my.
I was surprised that
largely
you're
on
not
my iPad nowadays, and I do subscribe to the Times Online, and which I do get a lot out of. And the reason that I do that largely is because I work in the legal sector. Often that's where the law reports are, and it's the sort of paper of record for that. So that's kind of why. Yes, it's difficult to say. The quote about the Birmingham, the Trinity Mirror quote about, we can't be expected to cover everything on our patch. Part of me thinks, is that because they don't have the capacity to do it? And then part of me thinks, no, what I think they mean is, in a way, there is more news. There seems to be more news happening than ever, really. There seems to be sort of news all over the place. There aren't really such things as slow news days anymore. There's just things happening all the time. But maybe the reason why it seems like there is news all the time is that there are far, far more ways in which to get news. And I think, actually, I don't think this might be a slightly controversial theory. I don't think the internet has necessarily done for newspapers. I think rolling news on TV channels is perhaps as damaging for newspapers, because And it works in the same way as the internet, I suppose, in that once something has broken on rolling, the thing about rolling news is you can always catch up with it, can't you? It's always updating. It's always, there's a reporter on the scene, you know, there's always updating. Whereas the problem with, you know, old school newspapers is, you know, they're produced once or twice a day, maybe. Some papers have, you know, early editions and evening editions, particularly the local papers. The EDP, the Eastern Daily Press, when I lived up in East Anglia, used to do that. But news, it's clunky, isn't it? It's a bit like turning an oil tank around, you know, reporting the news once a day, whereas we don't seem to be in that kind of world anymore. And I don't know if the way that the world is changing has meant that rolling news and the internet sprung up, or whether the internet and rolling news has therefore changed the way in which we consume news and makes it seem like there's more of it. I don't know. But yes, I am very, very fond of newspapers. But ultimately, but the pricing is a problem as well. I really resent having to pay £3 for a Saturday Guardian when I can read most of it online.
And it's £3, Juliet. Seriously, it's £3.
Like that. Well, the weekly paper is £1.80 now, I think. I gave £2 over the other day when I did actually buy one that and got very little. I'm just trying to look it up now, actually, because I think it's about...
I believe you, but that's extraordinary.
I think the Observer is around that time. Guardian prices, because it does come with lots of pullouts. But then I remember, you know, buying a... So it says here, the Guardian reports on the Guardian on the 8th of April, says Guardian to increase cover price by 20p. We'll take the weekday cost to, so the price pay rise is coming in from Saturday the 16th of April. So that's been a while ago I bought this, because the weekday print edition is now £2.
Oh,
and the
right.
Saturday edition is £2.90.
My word. I mean, that is really pushing isn't it? That's pushing it to its limit.
We talked previously about maybe that's unique to the Guardian in that, you know, we've got this problem whereby they won't monetize online. Rusbringer, we've talked about his, you know, decisions before, the sale of Auto Trader, whether some of those business decisions have been, to quote John Lemessurier, really quite wise, sir. So of course, if the Guardian isn't raising money online or from, you know, profitable parts of its business have been sold off, then obviously it has to try and find a way of and again, there are lots of Guardian redundancies happening left, right and centre. So I don't know. I think, you know, the Guardian's finances are particularly precarious compared to a lot of the newspapers, particularly as it's lower circulation. So, you know, there's less of a room for it. We've seen the Indigo. I would be sad if the Guardian went, but it wouldn't surprise me if it did go the same way. It's the papers that, I mean, the Daily Mail is a paper which, although I dislike it and a lot of its views and a lot of its ethos, has managed to make a go of its online platform. It's weirdly made a kind of a go of things without having to monetize through its advertising, and its website has by far and away the most hits, with the infamous sidebar and shame at that. But again, at what journalistic cost? You know, you get more and more clickbaity articles, and, you know, more outpourings from, you know, I don't want to name names, but various people. And you do think, is this going to, you know, I don't know. I don't know what the future is.
Well, your theory about the 24 rolling news is interesting, and it holds water, I think, because, of course, America was the originator of the 24-hour rolling news. And it's not just in the UK that this the redundancies and layoffs are happening. The New York Times has reported this week a 6.8% downturn in advertising revenue, most of it accounted for, by the way, of losses in print advertising. It's not its online version. So the New York Times is cutting about 70 jobs, offering journalists what they call in America, they call it buyout programs. We call it voluntary redundancies.
Yeah.
And, you know, there has to be a point where, when you have so few staff that you can't really pretend to be a newspaper anymore.
And that's what I think that the Trinity Mirror might have been alluding to. They'd also been cut so much that they didn't really have the capacity to do anything anymore.
No, that's right. And I was thinking of perhaps a rather odd example, but I think it makes sense. The New Musical Express, the NME, being a sort of current example.
Something else that we've criticised in the past.
Indeed, but now, you know, with so few staff and you know, it's really just a thin few pages of adverts.
Really, I have a copy next to me, which I picked up when I went to Brighton fairly recently. There's a fairly good piece about PJ Harvey in here, which is probably partly why I picked it up. There's quite an interesting open page spread about the about the doctor's strike, which is interview made. It's got some film. Actually, I've leafed through this, and quite a lot of the content is quite good, but it is very saturated by advertising. I mean,
the editorial is very thin.
It is.
You think of the NME and its glory days. I know. Ian Penman, Danny Kelly, Danny Baker.
Comparing like with like. I'm just saying, you know, and there's a. You know, even if it's not an advertising, it's sort of an advertorial in that there's a full page on things we like for your record store day hall. So various turntables and news of where you can buy them. But inevitably, they're all from places like Urban Outfitters. So it's not really for your serious audiophile, shall we say. I speak as someone that does proudly own a Crossley and has taken a lot of stick for it. But you know what I mean? It's like you say, the Rolling News as well, by the way. Your point about Rolling News is a good one. You say it was invented by the US. It was, but actually the popularisation of Rolling News in the UK, I think, is partly down to the day-to-day as well, which rather scarily predicted Rolling News. Yes. My other point about Rolling News, which is slightly off topic, but it always makes me laugh. Have you ever seen, do you watch Outnumbered, the TV programme with the children in it?
No, I know of it, but I don't watch it often.
It's very funny, and there's one where the granddad is staying with them, and he's watching Rolling News that purports to be BBC News, and it shows a train carriage that's come off tracks, and he says, one of the kids goes, "Are you all right, granddad?" And the granddad says, "There's been 3 train crashes in the last 20 minutes, all of them in Kent." So whenever Excellent. I think of Rolling Excellent. News, I think of 3. And whenever I go and see my parents, if I have News 24 on, someone will always walk in and say, "Have there been 3 train crashes in Kent in the last 20 minutes?" So in a way, you don't get that kind of confusion with newspapers. And actually, that's the downside of Rolling News. It can be very, very repetitive if you have to fill air. And there's nothing else that's happened. I think of, you know, a transfer deadline day, or otherwise known as men standing in car parks day. And in a way, newspapers don't have that. And that's why it's quite good to read a newspaper, because you have a sort of a settled account of the news that's happened, rather than something that is still happening and may or may not be accurate. And that's the reason why I think that newspaper reporting is quite often a bit more accurate than TV or Rolling News reporting, because there is not that pressure to say anything to fill time, and therefore there's less conjecture. I think anyway there's less flannel, there's less theorizing in order to fill space. So in a way, I do feel that whilst Rolling News is very good in many ways and has kind of done for newspapers a bit, I do feel sorry for newspapers at the same time. I think that they do have their plus points, but I think the problem is, particularly in the case of The Guardian and Rosbrugger, they didn't see the iceberg coming until it was far, far too late, I think. I think the papers that have been able to survive it, people like The Mail, who were savvy enough to realise that they weren't going to turn the tide, and you either, you know, you get on board and get pulled along rather than getting overwhelmed, I think.
Talking about your Outnumbered story, bless him, my late father, when he was still with us, he used to watch, in his last couple of years, he used to watch Sky Sports News all day. And it was the same thing, Rolling News. And my mother would sort of be popping into the living room, the sitting room, from time to time. And, you know, by about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, she would say to my father, "If I hear that story about Frank Lampard again, I'm going to throw something at that television." So,
McGrath's excellent autobiography, which is about his sort of drinking problems, talked about his desperate attempts to rehabilitate himself, and he got really into going to the gym. And he said that there always used to be Rolling News Sky Sports bulletins on. And he said that sometimes he used to spend so long there in an attempt, you know, to get fit and to sort of keep his mind occupied. He said there was one particular day when he knew all the Rolling News bulletins by heart, because they'd been repeated so many different times that, you know, he had it. So yeah, it's difficult to know. In the cases of some newspapers, like The Times, for example, put a paywall up. People criticised it. It seems to have kept them going. The Mail, like them or not, have found a way of making a website that works. Whether or not it's, you know, horribly clickbait is up for debate. The Indie didn't find a way of sorting it out, and now have only do online. You know, I think the newspapers will be split between those that manage to survive by finding savvy ways of operating and those that don't. And, you know, to be honest, it's a bit like Morrison's not having online shopping until very, very recently. In a way, the die was cast by not making the decision 2 or 3 years ago, really. And I am sorry to hear of all the job losses, particularly Vice, which I was really, really shocked about, because all the noise coming out of Vice was, you know, oh, it's the hit new young thing and they're expanding. And then all of a sudden, something like their whole editorial team in the UK has been laid off or something, apart from two. And actually,
quite right.
although, you know, I suppose it's for us young people, quote unquote, haha. I was talking to someone the other day and he said that actually he got a lot of political insight. Some of the Vice writing, the news writing, is actually, there are some really good long articles. Obviously, they're inclined towards things that are sometimes not, you know, massively palatable. But I found it to have a really good insight into that cursive word millennials. I actually found some of the stories on it to be doing things in a knowing way that other newspapers like The Guardian would try and do it, and it would be massively clodhoppery. So my thoughts are with Vice. I am sorry that they are, and again, that was largely an online opera, but I've only ever consumed Vice online, so I don't
know. Yeah, so it's all there. Yeah, it's always awful to hear anybody losing their jobs, of course. What will Jose Mourinho bring to Manchester United, and will it all end in tears?
Yeah, next story.
Next story. That's next, right after Saint Etienne.
Raise a flight upon the gown to pain. Dust that settles on the balustrade. I'm opening my eyes to find sun in my morning.
This is what I see.
Sun in my morning.
Perfectly 1967 Beach Boys-ish, Laurel Canyon, Sunshine, psychedelia about that track.
It's all things for all people, isn't it, that track? There's a lot going on in there.
There is. From the 2005 album, Tales from Turnpike House, that's Saint Etienne, and Sun in My Morning.
And that was an excellent choice by you, Terence, because I always think that Saint Etienne album, the Turnpike House one, is always a bit overlooked, really, of all of their kind of canon. People talk about Fox Base Alpha, obviously, which is great, and Good Humour is a record of theirs that I love, which has got Sylvia on. But actually, I think Turnpike House is always a bit overlooked, and it's really nice to hear something from that, actually. I think it's a beautiful album.
I love Saint Etienne, and in particular, I adore Sarah Cracknell's voice.
She's just got it, hasn't she? And I did a cover at an open mic night of He's on the Phone once, and I finished it, and my friend said, well, that was very good, but I'm really sorry. You don't quite sing as lovely as Sarah Cracknell does. And I said, well, who does apart from Sarah Cracknell, really? So
there is that.
My bandmate toured with them once, she tells a favourite story in the pub, which starts with her having to film a video from 6 o'clock in the morning until midnight, waking up with a howling cold, going off to tour with Saint Etienne from London to Manchester, arriving in some state of illness by this point, deciding the best way to deal with this was to drink half a bottle of Night Nurse and then have two pints of cider and a joint. And she came on, she went on stage, she sang, you know, she did the gig and walked off stage and straight off stage and threw up in Sarah Crackner's dressing room. And that was her first interaction with Sarah Crackner, who I suspect was not a great fan for that entire week when they toured.
It would be an unforgettable moment.
She said some of my interactions with famous people I admire have been excellent and some have been less excellent. And I suspect that might have been in the less excellent period.
Well, as we record this podcast on the evening of Thursday, 26th of May, Jose Mourinho has his no doubt sponsored fountain pen poised about to sign the contract.
Yes, with Chelsea crossed out on it, imagine.
Scrubbed out in crayon, yeah. And that will confirm he's the new manager of Manchester United. Mel, what a world, Jules. Mm. The process has been drawn out due to Mourinho's existing image rights. In 2014, he signed endorsement deals with Jaguar Cars, Hublot, I'm not sure, wristwatches, and some South Korean casino operator.
He's such a man of taste and integrity, isn't he, Jose?
Yes. Unfortunately, Manchester United have deals with Chevrolet for cars, not Jaguar, Bulova for watches, and a different South Korean casino resort.
There were so many. Clearly, it's a big deal, isn't it?
It's extraordinary. Thus, negotiations have not been about how to manage a football club, but more about how to manage commercial interests. And Jules, surely there's never been such a delicious metaphor for modern football. And I wonder how all this will look in early November if Manchester United are 15th in the league table with 10 points and Mourinho is blaming the ball boys at Burnley for their latest defeat.
Absolutely, yes. You know, as you say, what a world, you know, what else can you use to describe that, really? It's just ridiculous, isn't it, really? This is the mess that football has got itself into. It's gradually eating itself. And it's always, I could go off on a separate rant about people that endorse wristwatches and what it says about them. You know, Kevin Peterson being exhibit B in this case. But anyway, yes, he's been terribly wronged, etc., etc. Kevin Peterson fans everywhere. To sort of dial it back a bit, to talk about whether or not Jose, I haven't got much else to say about how ridiculous it is. It just is, isn't it? Where do you end, you know?
But it will end in tears.
Well, yes, exactly. In terms of where Jose will end at Manchester United, yes, in tears and a P45 and a massive payoff, I suspect. I don't particularly like Van Gaal. I never thought he'd come across well. There have been some really interesting stories, and I think it was one of the Guardian reporters, which everyone then picked up on.
Yes, it was in the
Guardian. Yeah, published. Yes. It was there first, but then it ended up everywhere. I think it was Daniel Harris or someone like that. Apologies if I've got that wrong, but it was one of those. It was whoever it was that supports Manchester United at the Guardian that always manages to get the kind of inside goss, said, you know, along the lines of, you know, how Van Gaal's methods of trading the players, the criticism and the feedback thing. Did you read the article, presumably?
I did, the ridiculous
thing about the idea that he would have these kind of review sessions on the Monday. They weren't allowed the day off anymore on Monday. They had to go in, watch a full video replay of the game, at which point Van Gaal would smash into whichever player it was that had gone wrong that week in front of everyone else. And eventually Michael Carrick and Wayne Rooney, who are not two individuals that are known necessarily for being particularly forthright or bolshy, for someone that's so shouty on the pitch at time. Wayne Rooney, I think, has a reputation as being quite a grafter and quite a sort of quite a loyalist, I think, really. And they both went and said to Van Gaal, you know, this isn't really working. It is rather demoralising people. Can you not do that anymore? So his solution was to send every player an email instead of setting out their individual faults, what they needed to improve on. And he suspected that some players were deleting them without reading them, perish the thought. So he then installed a tracker, which then showed him what emails were opened. And I did very much, and I would do a similar thing. In fact, there were reports of certain players leaving their phone open, not the email, on the side for about 20 minutes, nipping off and doing something else and then coming back, so they had been open for 20 minutes. Of course they've been reading it, which is such an innovative solution. It really is. It's like teenage boys that I knew going off on year 9 camp, not washing and then wetting their flannels before they went home so their mothers knew that they'd washed. It's a bit like that, really. It's just so the Jose Mourinho thing. Actually, I've been thinking about this, and I read one of the newspapers. It might have been the Times or the Telegraph. I was reading a newspaper that had been left somewhere. And I came to, I think it was the Times on Tuesday, I think. And I came to the conclusion that actually the problem, I don't think now at Manchester United, is about a manager anymore. And it's not about following Sir Alex Ferguson anymore. That's gone. He's gone. The problem is Ed Woodward, I think. I mean, to some extent, the Glaziers and how they've been rinsing Manchester United for ridiculous amounts of money with these daft loans for years. But Ed Woodward, the chief executive, the original excuse when, not excuse, the original explanation when Ferguson left and they had that rubbish summer was that David Moyes and Ed Woodward were both new and neither of them had done a big transfer window anymore. So that was, you know, ever before. So that was the problem then. Ed Woodward strikes to me like someone who is out of his depth, who doesn't necessarily operate in quote unquote the Manchester United way, which is tedious, I know, but Manchester United have a history, they have a certain ethos there. Jose Mourinho does not fit with that at all. The best demonstration with that would be someone wrote something along the lines of, oh, and Ryan Giggs' latest jobs is sorting out lodgings for when Martial, Rashford and Cameron Borthwick are all sent out on loan this season. Because Jose's reputation is not someone that develops young players. And for all of Van Gaal's faults, he was actually very good at that. I don't think under the old way of Manchester United, Van Gaal would have been sacked in quite the embarrassing way that he was, following on from David Moyes being sacked in similar circumstances, i.e. by press rather than him. I mean, Van Gaal's wife was calling him at Wembley to say she was reading it in the press. Yes. When, you know, when he was trying to coach them to win the... there was something very poignant about Van Gaal walking in with the trophy under his arm to a press conference where he then had to discuss if he was leaving or not. I blame a lot of this on Ed Woodward. I don't think he's managing that... he's running that club properly at all. Mourinho is not a youth person. If you're complaining about not having exciting football, I don't think Mourinho is necessarily going to be the answer to that. I don't understand in what world Mourinho is the answer to that. Yes, he will probably win you things for a couple of seasons. There will be some massive, massive falling out. I thought Van Gaal's statement, resignation statement, was really classy, and it thanked all the levels of staff, catering staff. I can't imagine Jose Mourinho doing that for one second, particularly when it comes to physios, ha-ha. And I just can't see it working. And do you know what the sad thing is? I do actually think the answer for the manager of Manchester United is probably Ryan Giggs.
May yet come to pass. Could be in 3 months.
I think that if
he stays,
yes, and that's the big question, isn't it? And I actually think that the best thing they could do, and this is how Stuart Pearce and Gary Neville, I know they haven't, Stuart Pearce perhaps had more managerial success than Gary Neville, but what he needs to do is he needs a team to manage that's a, I could see Ryan Giggs in charge of the under 21 squad rather than being the assistant manager to Mourinho. If he's put in charge, or maybe, I don't know, England under 21s, if he was put in charge of a young team or a sort of a reserve team, I think a young team would be better. It's embarrassing, isn't it? But if he was put in charge of a young team at Manchester United, I think that would develop him to be the manager at Manchester United, because I think he, more than anyone else, understands the ethos of that club. And I think actually, you know, you can't always go with tried and tested managers. You know, I think he'd be a good shout, to be honest.
I agree with you. I think Giggs should stick it out because his chance may come sooner rather than later. Because I think unless Mourinho has changed his entire psychological makeup in the last 6 months.
Which is possible. I mean, it's not implausible, it's because I think that Mourinho, I don't want to call him a snake, but I think that he does have a really hard streak through him. And actually, when wasn't that infamous 6-page letter that he sent to Manchester United, setting out the things, the ways in which he would be good for the job? That suggested to me that he might be willing to think about changing things. But like you say, it seems unlikely, but it doesn't seem completely impossible.
No, I'm calling it, though. I'm saying that this latest Man United odyssey will end in tears, recriminations and chaos. Because, yes, he may have changed, but I so doubt it, because his pattern, the Mourinho pattern, is so well established. A huge transfer pot of money at the beginning, an influx of big stars. This is what he did at Chelsea. Yes. Instant success. And then, as sure as night follows day, arguments and distress, disenchanted players, demotivation, then the blame game. It's never his fault. Media rants, monologues to Jeff Shreves, And then it, you know, it turns to end paparazzi photos of an unshaven Mourinho being hustled into a limo.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, before the whole process starts over, and no doubt, of course, Jules, the image rights will be even more complicated next time
absolutely.
Round.
Although I suspect if he fails at Manchester United, I'm not sure Cardiff City or wherever will quite have the same issues. I don't know. Maybe I'm just being a bit blasé. But yes, when Mourinho was sacked, me and a friend did Britpop punning song titles to do with football, and unfortunately Terrorvision had a song called Alice What's the Matter going to do at Manchester United. Yes, I know. I have sympathy for Matter because it's a bit like someone telling me that my most hated boss of all time was coming to be my supervisor in 2 weeks time. I would be, well, I don't suppose footballers send their CVs out places, do they? But I would be putting feelers out to leave, I think.
Yes, I agree with you. And you mentioned it earlier. I suppose some of my antipathy is based. I can never forget, and I do find it hard to forgive what happened to Eva.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree. It was vile. And if you, I mean, obviously, I think it's vile. But and I don't know how to put it without sounding clumsy, but football fans are very, very, very forgiving of our clubs, aren't we? And sometimes a bit like some political supporters, I'm not saying who, we're sometimes a bit blind to the world being as it is rather than how we want it to be. And so therefore, we might forgive things that we wouldn't necessarily in others. But so if a lifelong Chelsea fan like you is saying, God, that was appalling, that's not good, is it really? That's not a good sign.
No. Juliet will be explaining why you wouldn't want to send Robbie Williams to do your supermarket shopping. It's right after Marvin Gaye and I Want You.
Somewhere, somehow, oh baby, I
it's moving away from the traditional Motown sound and towards a funkier mid-70s disco feel. Marvin Gaye and the title track from his 1976 album, I Want You.
I wish that someone had done a hit a compilation called The Many Moods of Marv, because he had many, many different moods, didn't he? That was sort of more up-tempo Marv rather than sort of love hunk Marv or Sunny Soul Day Marv.
I was checking to see when the year this came out. I noticed that he in his career 83 singles released, which is extraordinary. Yes, I Want You and I Want You to Want Me Too. That plaintive line, it's the story of my life, Jules. Women I fall in love with decide they can happily carry on without me in their lives, and similarly, women who tell me that they love me, I think, well, that's all very nice, but you know, I may not be feeling it.
Welcome to my world, Terence.
It's a paradox, Jules, isn't it?
We can share, except it's more of the former than the latter for me, sob, but never mind. Postcards to the usual address if any ladies are interested. But
I'm not sure if it's a paradox or a dichotomy. I'm not sure which it is.
Or such other big, big meaningful words, yes.
Now you spotted a story this week that has led you to wonder if some celebrities they simply don't know what day it is, or certainly couldn't tell you the cost of a pint of milk. What's this story of Robbie Williams and what Wikipedia describes as a widely cultivated plant in the gourd family?
Well, you see, now I've accidentally become everything I hate once again, because my attention was drawn to a story from the Sidebar of Shame on the Mail Online, which is a report of something that had happened on Loose Women. Is this the future? Where is my jetpack, etc.? I don't really quite understand how I've ended up here, but it is a story of such utter silliness and also sort of deep thinking as well. It does make me laugh a great deal. So Robbie Williams, the Let Me Entertain You hitmaker, has a wife called Ada Field, with whom he's had a couple of children. He rather sort of entertainingly tried to live tweet and video some of her labour with one of the children, and did some regretful dancing with a bedpan to let it go while she was screaming. But I think he meant well. Robbie Williams is one of those people who you think means well. He's got that slightly intense, starey face that Ed Balls has a little bit as well. Maybe the two of them, I've never seen them in the same place. Anyway, his wife went on Loose Women and had a bit of a chat on the panel like they do. And it's always the sort of thing that I watch in doctors' waiting rooms. And they talked about her life with Robbie Williams. And she said that she had got a cucumber, the aforementioned vegetable, out of the fridge intact, and he didn't know what it was. She said, the other day I pulled out a cucumber from the fridge and he asked me what it was. He said he didn't know because he'd only ever seen them sliced. She said he's only ever had them in salads which have been sliced for him. He's not used to seeing them in their full form, which could cover a multitude of sins, couldn't it, really? And it led me to think... and she also said that she says he became famous at 15. There's a certain level of stunting when you're learning all these skills. And she said he'd never been to the supermarket before and was very taken by the fact that you could get all your foods in one place. This was quite exciting. Also, rather kiboshes my friend who claimed to have once seen Robbie Williams in Hailsham Waitrose. That presumably wasn't true after all. Mel. But she also said, when asked by fellow panellist Jerry Hewson, a.k.a. Maureen from Coronation Street soap fans, if Robbie ever did the vacuuming, she exclaimed, God no, he doesn't even know how to change a light bulb. She said, if it was up to him, we'd have Nando's and salad cream, morning, noon and night. And it made me think, is this wildly out of touch celebrity type thing? If you've been in a boy band since you're 15 and you've had people running around after you, is this just how it is? Or is there an ignorance amongst young people about fruits and veg? Do we have such convenience food-based diets that people don't know this anymore? And Terence, I know that you rely on me for dispatches from the front line.
Yes,
so
I
can report to you from two supermarkets.
Oh,
I went
excellent.
To the supermarket fairly recently and gave an avocado to the girl to scan through, and she said very politely, what is this? And unfortunately, rather embarrassing for her, because there were two avocados in a pack, and I said, it's an avocado. She went, ah, yes, that's why it's got avocado written on the front of it. She hadn't seen that. But she didn't know an avocado. A friend of mine went into Morrison's the other day and said, she put this as a Facebook status, buying lunch in Morrison's, cashier, are these nectarines or plums? To which she said, feeling shocked was her emotion on that Facebook status. I remember Joe Brand touring once gave us a story about having been on tour, and she gave a story about the different classes of audience that she came across. And she used to have a prop that she'd talk about, and it was a stick with a handle with a long piece of string on it, and a leather ring attached to the end. And she used to bring it out for a warm up to say to the audience, what do you think this is? And actually what it was an implement by which men would put the ring on their wife's finger and they would lead their wives around.
Oh!
It was used in the West Indies, I believe, or somewhere like that. So it was all rather unfortunate. She went to Cambridge and a lady said, is it a Kawavi juice extractor? And Terrence said, I don't know what a Kawavi is. Do you know what a Kawavi is, Terrence?
Well, you see,
No,
most certainly don't. And I gave a hollow laugh, you see, when you mentioned your avocado and nectarine stories. And that's because I have a great deal of sympathy for Robbie Williams. I'm not sure I'd recognise a cucumber in the wild either.
Really?
I've certainly never bought one. I mentioned last week that I've never followed a recipe, let alone buy a recipe book.
How do you live, Terrence? How do you eat? What happens?
Well, now you see. Here's the thing. I think many people, in America in particular, certainly under any Americans under the age of 60 and living in a city, would feel the same as me. I have friends in New York and Los Angeles. I tend to live a bit like this as well, who never cook at home. Breakfast is usually a pastry on the way to the office. Lunch is a sandwich or a snack board at the local deli or cafe. And dinner is almost always at a restaurant or a takeaway. I'm with Robbie and his Hollywood lifestyle, cooking whether with or without cucumbers, nectarines or avocados, highly overrated.
Fair enough, although I worry about you, Terrence. I worry about your health, you know, fresh fruit and veg. I mean, you're always telling me off for leading, you know, an overpacked lifestyle, but I do buy cucumbers. Sometimes they go mouldy where I don't have time to eat them, but I do. The thought is at least there, and it does make me wonder. We talked about the millennials eating breakfast in portable plastic cereal thing, and how that you understand that, and it depresses me, which is a complete turn up for the books, by the way. You'd completely expect it to be the other way around, but apparently not. I don't know. It does worry. I don't think it's indicative of Robbie Williams' lifestyle. My tales from the front line suggest to me that we young people don't know what fruit and veg is anymore. And I have to say that does depress me slightly, particularly given that we live in a world with, I know that our very own Rona and I have discussed on Twitter before, the tyranny of health bloggers. And this clean eating and all of that, and the strange cult of the avocado that seems to be living on various online food blogs. We seem to be, in a way, and I think this is a wider theme. Stop me if I'm being a bit of a Sue's corner in private eye, but it's almost in a way indicative of a more divided world in which we live now. And I feel certainly the way that things are going politically in Britain, that there is more inequality than ever. There's people that have a lot and people that don't really have very much at all. And in a way, we live in this weird kind, that's almost indicative of the fact that the top end of the scale is, you know, people talking about kale and quinoa and avocados and, you know, books with lovely illustrations for £20. And the bottom end, people don't know basic food and people don't know basic fruit and vegetables. And I find that mildly troubling, really.
I'm down with the young people, though. You see, I'll get my fruit. I'll get it from a carton. It's a juice, which, you know, is 100% fruit juice. I'll probably have two glasses of that in the morning. What's the difference between having that and appealing one of your nectarines or smashing one of your avocados?
And when you smashed avocado, always the best way to consume an avocado. And when you want me to come and help you find a new set of teeth, I will be more than happy to.
There is that. By the way, I described earlier cucumber as a member of the gourd family. Gourd is one of those lovely words to say out loud, I think. It's a good onomatopoeia, exfoliation, Gina Lollobrigida. These are all lovely words. Some words are just a joy to say out loud.
I like benevolence, personally, because it has the combination of, I like words with B's in for some reason, and you've got the bunner, and then you've got the V just to let it fly at the end. I think that's...
Bumblebee benevolence.
Oh, isn't that grand? What a time to be alive, Terrence, and all these words. It is very good indeed. I'm a big fan of this. And also, speaking of goods, my beloved former grandfather, he's still my grandfather, he's just
Want You Back for Good, one of Robbie Williams' hits.
Good grief, Terence. So yes, he's still he's not my former grandfather. He's still my grandfather, but not in a sense of actually being alive. He used to polish goods to elongate their lives. Can't think of the word, but to sort of maintain them. And he used to he didn't get any money for it, but he used to do them in little displays and win prizes for them at flower shows.
You just never know. Week to week, I just never know how these podcasts are going to end up.
They always end in a very wildly different place than which they started. But actually, maybe there is one person in Britain that cares about the fact my grandfather polished goods that isn't in my family. There is always that chance.
I'll never forget it. You could contact us if you wish. The best way is through...
all your GERD-related queries, yes.
All your GERD-related issues, yes, that's right. If it was the BBC, it was like, well, if you have issues with GERD...
If anyone you know has been affected by the GERD issues in this programme, you can call the BBC GERD Action Line on 0300.
SuperJules, at SuperJules84 is Julia on Twitter. At Sir Terence is myself on Twitter. There'll be people listening and saying to themselves, I'd like to hear more from that lovely Julia. Where can they satisfy that desire, Julia?
That is very kind. Thank you. It's nice that you think that. Next Wednesday, being the 1st of June, I will be on Barricade Radio again doing my Indie Wonderland show from 8 until 10 p.m, barricaderadio.com. I'll have a new track of the month for June and I'll be doing lots of tunes and chat. And by the time Saturday social, I think, I'm not sure if we'll do another podcast before then. So next Saturday, so not this coming Saturday, but Saturday the 4th, it will be the H installment in our A to Z of Northern Soul Motown Modern Misc. And that's 6 to 7 p.m. on the same station. So barricaderadio.com.
Thanks to Rona on her wee Scottish Isle.
Always a cheery wave to Rona up there. Always pleased to hear from her.
Her invaluable help. And thanks to you for listening. So to play out, Jules, we're heading down the road to Brighton.
Yes, we are, via France, interestingly. The artist in question is a young lady that performs under the name Captain Lovelace. It's basically just her, but she does have a backing band. I met her whilst DJing a gig last year. Very nice lady. She is a singer-songwriter type. She's from France originally. It was a track of the month for Indie Wonderland, I think in February time. It was earlier this year anyway, or March it might have been. And she was asked to record it for this compilation, which is called A Home. And it was released by Dig That Treasure Records to raise money for the Refugee Council. As part of the migrant crisis. And it's a really good compilation, actually. It's also got Kieran Leonard, Letitia Sadier from Stereo Lab, the Go Team. So various sort of names on there. And I really like this song. I think it's rather lovely. So this is Captain Lovelace and this is To Azamu.
Oh, You have been listening to a DAKM Media production.